Hi there. I'm Wendy Garrett. This is Conscious Living on Empower Radio. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate your time wherever you are. Hope you're enjoying your day, your time, your life. We've got all sorts of stuff happening in our world that we don't always have a good explanation for. Some people come up with things that they think might be plausible explanations, and others swear they have proof. And some say, well, this stuff just doesn't exist, so let's get on with living, and that's all there is to it. However, I'm one of those who's experienced things that other people say don't exist. So I enjoy exploring, and I enjoy talking to other people who compiled great histories, great stories, great little, little pictorials of life as other people see it. And when you write books and you run across this information, you get a really good dose of what might exist. You don't have to believe it, but you can certainly entertain the thought of what if. Nick Redfern has a great book out now and has several of them. He's not just a one-book wonder. Yay! He's done quite a few stories that give us a little closer glimpse into what might be considered as a different view of reality, period. And that's just, for me, the way it works. I don't think we see everything. I think each of us has a different window. Nick Redfern's latest book is about the Men in Black, that phenomenon. What might that be about? Hey, Nick, thanks for talking with me.
Well, thanks, Wendy. Thanks for having me on the show.
I like your specialty. You do all the unknown, the unexplained, the mysteries. And, you know, some of them can be, they're very easily written off as, okay, somebody had a bad night out. maybe that's not bad for them. It was like, oh, well, that was cool. But others really don't have an explanation. And the Real Men in Black is something that you've compiled stories that have been happening for quite a while that maybe give us a better glimpse into what this phenomenon is about. And it isn't just a real person like, you know, the movie. It's there's some other things going on that might have a paranormal link. How did this one get in your radar?
Well, I think probably more than anything else, Wendy, you know, you hit upon the fact that, you know, the Men in Black are sort of well-known in popular culture, movies and things like that. And, you know, this sort of alien imagery that we get from, you know, the Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones films. And they're entertaining, fun movies. But the reality of the situation is actually quite different. And I think sort of popular culture and Hollywood have sort of nurtured this image of secret agents running around, you know, investigating UFO sightings, silencing witnesses, etc. And certainly that is a part of the Men in Black mystery. But one of the main reasons I wanted to write the book was because that is actually only a very small part of what's going on with the Men in Black and who they might be. Ironically, the real story is far stranger than anything that Hollywood has ever put out. And getting to speak to a lot of people at conferences, etc., they assume that, you know, the mystery, if you like, was very much a new one or just created by Hollywood, you know, for people who weren't aware of the history of it. And so that was one of the main reasons in writing the book, was to sort of set the record straight and define the fact from the fiction, if you like.
Okay, so how far back does it go?
Well, I mean, in terms of the UFO field, at least, it goes back till the early ages of the flying saucer era, which kicked off in 1947 with Kenneth Arnold, a pilot who witnessed a fleet of strange objects over Washington State that became known as flying saucers. You know, this sort of gave birth to the modern era. Now, Men in Black sightings weren't that prevalent, just very, very rare in sort of 47, 48, 49. But the phenomenon really kicked off in the early 1950s with a man named Albert Bender. And Albert Bender was a resident of Bridgeport, Connecticut. And he was someone who had a lot of interest in paranormal phenomena, supernatural issues, etc., long before the UFO era kicked off itself. And I guess when UFOs became the next big thing, you know, it was kind of inevitable that Bender was going to gravitate towards them, which he did. And he set up a UFO research group in the town he lived in, Bridgeport, called the International Flying Saucer Bureau. And the group actually grew to literally like stratospheric proportions. There were chapters opened up in England and Australia and all over the place. And Bender found himself literally answering mail by the sackload every night. And it became, briefly at least, a very powerful group within the US and elsewhere. And this was made all the more stranger by the fact that within a year of setting the group up, Bender abruptly closed it down and alluded to a number of friends that he'd received this weird visit from three guys in black suits who essentially told him if he knew what was good for him and he wanted to keep his health and sanity and life, you know, he would leave the UFO subject behind and do something else instead. And he kind of got the message, and that's exactly what he did. He walked away. Now, because Bender only sort of alluded to friends as to what happened, this sort of provoked the idea that he'd been silenced by, you know, the CIA or the FBI or somebody like that. But Bender briefly resurfaced in the early 60s to put the record straight because people had been apparently, you know, sort of distorting the story, etc. And in his own book called Flying Saucers and the Three Men, published in 62, the story is very different. He talks about how these MIB, they sound like something straight out of like a gothic vampire novel. He talks about them wearing these sort of black suits and looking very, very thin and skinny, pale-faced, sunken cheeks with these glowing eyes. And they would sort of follow him in the streets, down the old streets and alleyways of Bridgeport late at night, sort of terrorizing and menacing him. And they would literally sort of manifest in his dreams and nightmares at night and sort of like in a spectral, ethereal fashion. So it's kind of ironic that the man who is responsible for creating, if you like, the Men in Black imagery actually talked about nothing to do with, you know, the sort of Hollywood imagery of government agents. It was very more like, for Bender at least, a paranormal slash supernatural experience.
And I want to come back to that in just a minute because I have something to add to that. If you're listening and you haven't heard of Nick Redfern, check out his books, nickredfernbooks.blogspot, and you'll find out more about the areas he specializes in. He does all sorts of content, including as a writer for UFO Magazine, Fate, 14 Times, Paranormal Magazine, stuff that it pretty much encompasses everything that we consider more of it, like an alien or an unknown UFO mystical type thing. And what I like about this is when that story does address this paranormal thing. That's what I had, a connection in a dream, and the Men in Black arrived in this black Cadillac. I had no interest in this kind of stuff, and the intuitive thing, yeah, that was okay, but when I got into this, it's like, oh, good grief. And in the dream, they have come up to me and said, we need you to start doing what you agreed to come here to do. It referred to interviewing people like you.
Wow.
And doing this content. So I thought that dream has been about a couple years ago now, but that was a prompt to say, okay, you know, quit ducking. And, you know, this isn't the deep end. This is the real end of the spectrum where people are learning more about what this stuff might be instead of just assuming they already know what it is.
Yeah.
So that part of it, there's more to it, but the experiences I have had have much more of a mystical paranormal element to them. And part of it is because I don't have that fear. I'm not afraid. You also conclude in here that some of this stuff that's happened has also seemed to trigger more stuff going on when people are afraid. You want to address that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's very interesting what you said, Wendy, about the Cadillac, because that's one of the staple parts of many Men in Black accounts, namely that, you know, they drive these old-style black Cadillacs, and, you know, they kind of really stand out when people see them, so to speak. So that's an interesting angle. But, yeah, I mean, when you talk about the, you know, sort of paranormal slash supernatural angle of things, I mean, this is a big part of the Men in Black mystery, and, you know, you bring up the fear angle. Now, there are a number of cases on record where, you know, people ask, well, why do the Men in Black silence people? You know, what's their agenda? Now, in some cases, you know, the incident is a very profound one. In other cases, it's less profound and, you know, arguably just mundane. So why on earth would the Men in Black be silencing people in those cases? And it's a good question. When we look at the phenomena at a deeper level, it seems to be the possibility exists that the silencing of people is actually secondary to instilling fear in the person. In other words, you know, it's not a case of just going to silence people to hide the truth about UFOs, but that's kind of a ruse. The actual idea, if you like, is to create fear in the person, which possibly the Men in Black, if they're paranormal entities, feed on. In simplistic terms, you know, the idea that there's some sort of supernatural, parasitic, vampire-type creature that feeds on high state of human emotion. So that may be the reason for instilling the fear. And one of the things that a number of people have pointed out quite correctly is that a number of witnesses to the Men in Black have reported afterwards how when the MIB have left, they just feel totally drained and, you know, lacking in energy, kind of like, as one person said it, like a diabetic who, you know, missed two meals and was starting to crash. You know, so this does sort of provoke that image of the MIB sort of bleeding dry the energy of the witness via instilling a state of high tension or fear, if you like.
Well, and from a metaphysical standpoint, sometimes when we are doing our own, there's a connect with something that might be considered supernatural, and we are doing our own drawing to be able to maintain that state, we drain ourselves. And if you don't know how to recharge, then you create this same kind of thing that somebody who isn't experienced with that might determine as, oh, I've been sucked dry. No, you participated in this, and in order to keep that thing going, then you are also adding your own energy. So that's the dynamic that, for at least that I have experienced, that adds a different element to this equation as well.
And I think, you know, you bring up another important point when you talk about you not having fear. I think very often with the MIB experiences, the mindset of the person does have a great deal of influence on how the experience proceeds. It's almost as if the MIB know that, you know, if you're of a certain, somebody's of a weak character, etc., they're easy to be manipulated and used. And somebody who isn't, it almost like it rewires their programming and they don't really know how to react to it.
Well, I tell you, when you experience this, and the fear thing, I think in some ways is a self-protection mechanism, because if you are going to talk about this as a logical, a real, not an abnormal thing, but a legit experience, you have to have a very sound sense of, I know who I am, I know what I experienced, like the movie, I Know What I Saw. You have to be very grounded in your own persona to be able to take this out and say, this is what I went through. Because if you are shaky or insecure, or again, that fear-based thing, then you're going to have to look for everybody else to, did I really have this? Did it really happen? Am I going crazy? You go through that first. But when this stuff,
right.
You know, when this stuff happens, you have to be able to integrate it. And I think that's why I wanted to talk with you about these cases, because there are some wonderful cases in here that don't make sense the way we tend to believe, with this logical thing of everything happening that we can see for a specific reason. This goes against all of that. The favorite story that you have from this collection, what would you say that is?
Well, you put me on the spot now. That's kind
Yay.
Of difficult.
Choose a child, quick.
Well, I think one of the ones that I find particularly fascinating is a case involving a friend of mine named Marie Jones. Marie's a well-known author who lives on the West Coast, and she's written a number of books on paranormal phenomena and things like the 2012 controversy and things like that. And in the 1990s, Marie and one of her friends, they live on the West Coast of California, and they set up like an abduction, an alien abduction research group, but also like a support group for people as well who've been traumatized by these experiences. And the more they hooked up with abductees and tried to help them, the more that Marie and her friend found themselves essentially kind of targeted by the Men in Black. And it was sort of like a two-pronged attack. Her friend would literally get sort of visitations at the front door by these weird sort of creepy little robotic men dressed in black who would make it very clear that they wanted her to stop the abduction research. And in Marie's case, she started to get something which is another aspect of Men in Black, of the history of the phenomenon. People get weird phone calls, like for telephone harassment. And that's exactly what Marie got. She would be, you know, sitting at home late at night, say, in the bedroom, and the phone would ring, and she'd pick it up, and it would be this weird robotic voice telling her what she was wearing, which room she was in, even perhaps which book was on the bedside table, you know, as if it had got sort of an inroad into her mind and, you know, home almost. And this really unnerved Marie to the point where she said enough's enough, and she walked away from the abduction research. And sure enough, when she did that, the Men in Black went away as well, and the same applied to her friend. So this was sort of very creepy, weird experience that was sort of full of paranoia and what sounds like some sort of, you know, very strange surveillance of both Marie and her friend. And you know, to the point where it really intimidated them. And that's something the MIB are very good at, unfortunately, is, you know, achieving the goal that they want to achieve. So, you know, this was sort of definitely one of the weirder stories in the book, you know, the idea that the men in black don't just, you know, target witnesses or people like that, but, you know, they focus on people in all aspects of the phenomenon and almost to, or literally to a sort of a very personal, pretty terrifying extent as well.
I think part of that, it gives people an idea that before you poo-poo somebody else's reality, you better be darn sure of your own. And this gives you an idea that just because you can't see it doesn't mean it isn't happening. And it doesn't mean that this has not occurred in some way, shape, or form in somebody else's lifestyle. A lot of times what we do is we write people off as, you know, just totally, totally bonkers and say, yeah, you're a kook, and then discount the story. And that's, I think, the very least of our good responses. It's just saying, okay, well, what if, you know, suspend your doubt for a moment and consider. And I think with the Men in Black, once you start getting into this, it's a, for me, it is a paranormal, it's a supernatural, and it may be supranatural that we are able to access this information now because we're more aware of other states of being, states of awareness, altered states, if you might. And that, I think, gives us a very real understanding of what the shaman have been experiencing for eons, that we aren't just this manifest physical being. We are metaphysical, and we are also multidimensional. And so this gives us another clue as to how some of these experiences might be integrated or part of our encounter in this other realm that most people in the 9-to-5 say doesn't exist, and they prefer seeing it on the movie screen when, you know, the real thing is a whole lot more interesting.
Oh, it is. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the ironic things is that I think, you know, a story that told the weirder aspects and the, you know, of the, and the more accurate aspects of the Men in Black mystery would be far more entertaining than just some sort of, like, outer space equivalent to James Bond or something like that, you know.
Well, there's a story where you follow, I can't remember the guy in the book, where he refuses to let it go. He refuses. He's like a dog with a bone. He just keeps on going back to the story. Mm-hmm. And is that Albert?
You mean who sort of really kicked it all off, Albert Bender?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's someone I focus on a lot in the book, not just because his story is a very, very interesting one, but because it really defines the nature of the phenomenon. And also, it's full of various strands that, you know, pull us towards this paranormal pathway. And, you know, when you have the man talking about seeing these strange creatures manifest in his dreams, and what's interesting is that he also talks about, before they would appear, he would enter like an altered state of mind. And, you know, I think this is important because it suggests that this phenomenon has the ability to possibly, you know, manipulate the way we see it or the way we experience it by, you know, I won't say in simplistic terms hypnotizing us, but it certainly has the ability to affect, I think, you know, the human mind and to an extent control it. And so essentially the MIB appear, you know, in a fashion that they want to appear. And I think there's some evidence to suggest, like your experience, you know, I don't, from what you've told me and based upon other cases similar to yours that I've looked into, I don't for 1 minute think what you had was a straightforward dream. I think what happens is that these entities have the ability to interact directly with our dream state. And they can influence our dreams and even enter them. I know that sounds to some people probably controversial, but I think there's evidence to suggest they do that. And they did that with Bender, that some of his experiences may have occurred not in sort of the physical 3D world, but in an altered state of mind that the MIB had provoked and then manipulated.
Well, I tell you what, the information that I get from this, and because part of it is I came at it from a mystical angle, from having this awakening, this incredible experience of oneness and of being out of the body and not being stuck in this physical dimension and realizing, oh my gosh, that was real too. Well, then this thing continued and continues now to happen where there is, as you said, that little altered state that you go into. And for me, that doesn't just, it isn't relegated to, you know, one specific time of day. It's a way of of being. And the other part of this was when during my waking hours, I was able to see certain things and given information telepathically that then made me more aware of how this enigma is present in our everyday reality, and we aren't usually tuned into it. But one of the things that they do say is do not telegraph your moves, don't interact, and they'll show you a different view of how things are happening around us at all times that we can, if we put ourselves in that altered state, become more aware of. But that mechanical voice is also a trigger. And the message was that fear is what is keeping us from becoming more aware of everything around us. And once we break through that, then we have a better, I think, chance of integrating and understanding what's really happening. Right now, to me, the men in black is basically a code, and it determines how far you're going to go. If you let fear rule your life, then all of these things are going to be dragons when really they're mice. It's just you deciding, oh, wow, and going into the Hollywood, you know, overdrive of creating your own movie that's a scary movie instead of oh, my God, let's take this out of into a larger context. So, yeah, I'm really excited that you have put this into a frame of reference for people to see some of these experiences. And the first thing, though, is there are other things to be said when you put yourself, I want to ask you about your own background. When you put yourself in this arena, you call this stuff to you as well. And that, I think, is part of somebody who starts becoming a paranormal research, part of the terrain. I want to know what you've experienced, whether it's men in black, whether it's paranormal, whether it's mystical. You know, I want to get into that in this next half hour. But I think that also gives us a real good awareness that there's a whole lot going on here that we haven't really yet begun to tap into. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense, yeah.
And just because the science isn't there to say all of this stuff is legit or real doesn't mean it may not one day exist, because science progressing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like 500 years ago, people would have been burned at the stake for saying the world was round, you know, instead of flat.
So,
And we couldn't prove it, really, you know, and it's kind of like, until science actually proves it, you know, it's like x-rays. X-rays have always been around. It's just that until we had the technical capability to understand them, we couldn't prove they existed. And I think that's the same with a lot of the paranormal. I honestly think that one day science, or, you know, fringe science, will solve what the, you know, the paranormal or the supernatural is. It's just right now we don't understand it in the same way, you know, 500 years ago we didn't understand atomic energy. So.
Well, it's another thing, too, to say that because we can't experience it, we won't be able to. And I think sometimes this stuff just opens. You aren't prepared. You aren't ready. You're not asking for it. It's there. And then your response determines how much more of it you get.
Yeah. And I think a lot of, you're right. I think a lot of our perceptions, ideas, even unconscious ones as to how, you know, things are going to progress, I think that has a lot to do with it. And, you know, very often it's a case that, you know, you kind of, what you ask for, you get, you know, and I really do think that happens. So it's like I always say to people, you know, don't dabble in these things, you know, recklessly, just take it very carefully.
All right, we're going to have to take a break, but we're talking with Nick Redfern, and we're going to come back. The Real Man in Black is the focus, but he's got some other information, contactees, alien stuff, and I want to ask him about his own personal experiences. Back with more Conscious Living on Empower Radio.
I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong. I'm home. And I love it, I'm home, where I belong.
It's always nice to come home, but these days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Fortunately, help is available. Making Home Affordable is a free program from the U.S. government that has already helped over 1 million struggling homeowners, and we want to help you.
I'm home, I'm home, and I love it, I'm home.
Find out now what your options are. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home where I've been.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Sassy!
This week's episode, Rattlesnake at the Pond.
Oh, Johnny, skipping rocks at the pond sure is fun.
Hey, look, a moving stick.
That ain't a stick. That's a rattlesnake.
Sassy, we're in danger.
Good idea, Sassy. Go get Mr. Gunderson. You will in a second, but first you'd like to tell us something we may not know about animal shelters in the United States?
It's getting close, Sassy.
Approximately 8 million pets enter shelters each year? The majority of which are in shelters because of owner-related issues that the animals have no control over?
Sassy, the rattlesnake! Save us, Sassy!
What, Sassy? You wish you were videotaping this? Sassy!
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
In 1977, in Johannesburg, South Africa, an 8-year-old boy picked up the game of golf from his father. By the age of 9, he was already outplaying him. The odds of that same boy then making it to the U.S. and European pro golf tours? 1 in 7 million. The odds of the Big Easy winning the Open Championship once and the U.S. Open Championship twice? 1 in 780 million. The odds of this professional golfer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Ernie Els encourages you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Hey there. I'm Wendy Garrett. This is Conscious Living on Empower Radio. Thanks for tuning in. We have a guest talking with us about all sorts of wonderful, unprovable, unbelievable, outlandish, outrageous, but legit experiences. It doesn't have to be proven to be legit. That's what I like about this stuff. If you have an amazing story and sometimes you're afraid to share it, it has more to do with that fear of being ridiculed or being an outcast or being just given some kind of wacky label that devalues the fact that you actually went through something and that you actually engaged or encountered something we have at this time no way to define or to give credit to. But that's where we come together to say, okay, this is what I've experienced. This is what I've gone through. These are the things I know about. How does that give us more information, more fodder, more content, more study that we can base our future, I guess, summaries from, our future experiments on? Nick Redfern, what was the thing that got you started? You said you were a big fan of Brad Steiger in the book. You say, hey, and now you're friends. So, hey, kudos on that. I like Brad too, but what got you started in this area aside from it being interesting and fun and all that?
Well, basically, the main reason was that when I was about 5 or 6 years old, my parents took me to Loch Ness, Scotland for a week's holiday. We went to Scotland, for a week. We spent a day at Loch Ness, and this sort of really, even at 5 years old, when my dad told me this story about the Loch Ness Monster as we stood on the shore, you know, at that age, you don't sort of equate tales of the Loch Ness Monster, you know, from a scientific perspective of could it be a surviving relic from a past era. You kind of more apply it to stories of monsters under the bed or in the closet, that sort of thing. And that's what I did, but it captured my imagination even at that age. And then when I was sort of about 9 or 10, I began reading books on things like the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot, and you know, this was sort of late 1970s, something like that. And what basically happened was that the more I dug into it, you know, I began to uncover the works of people like John Keel and Brad Steiger, and found this whole realm sort of really fascinating. And then went from sort of a little kid sort of standing wide-eyed on the shores of Loch Ness to digging into it personally. And one of the things that I found, as I went along, was that, you kind of gravitate to friends and colleagues in the field. You make friends and you make colleagues. And, the more I did that, I thought, well, you know, this is an interesting area to do research in and writing in. And this sort of coincided with when I left school. I began working on a music magazine back in England called Zero, and did that for a couple of years. And that sort of opened me up to the world of journalism. And that's basically what I did. You know, I began working as a journalist on a music magazine, and I still do quite a bit of that today. But then I thought, well, you know, why not try and combine the interest, you know, in paranormal stuff, going back to this experience of Loch Ness, and then, you know, combine it with the journalism background and just see where the two led, you know, or lead. And, you know, that's basically what I did. But in terms of personal, you know, paranormal experiences, etc., I've never fortunately had that sort of visit from the Men in Black, but or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it. What I have had is a lot of weird synchronicities. And, you know, I think this is an important aspect of the phenomenon, you know, when you're kind of driven down one particular pathway and, you know, it seems like, you know, something's guiding you almost to follow a specific line of research and hooking you up with the right people at the right place and at the right time. And, you know, and I don't discount this. I actually think synchronicities are an important aspect of our lives that we shouldn't ignore. And if they tell us something, we should follow the path, you know, that we're on. And one of the interesting things is that my wife gets a lot of strange synchronicities as well. So, you know, I kind of find that intriguing also.
What direction do you feel pulled at this point?
Well, you know, when I first got into the whole UFO scene and Bigfoot and everything else, you know, I felt that it was very much black and white, that, you know, UFOs were nuts and bolts spacecraft and that was all it was. And Bigfoot was just some sort of flesh and blood ape that had conveniently and successfully hidden from society forever, you know, with 100% success rate. But the more I dug into these things, the more I began to see that they weren't just weird. They were like too weird. You know, they seem beyond just what you would expect from natural phenomena. And that's one of the things that sort of surfaced with respect to synchronicities, is that I've been pushed sort of down the pathways that sort of that expand and, you know, sort of vindicate those sort of ideas, you know, putting me in touch with certain people who can add more to the paranormal aspect of the Men in Black mystery, or, you know, the supernatural aspects to things like the Loch Ness Monster and the Bigfoot mysteries, which actually have a lot of weird sides to them as well. So, you know, this is one of the things I've found. It's almost as if the synchronicities are telling me, you know, move away from just the nuts and bolts angle towards other aspects of the phenomena as well.
And I hope you do. I tell you, you know, my own stuff with this, there was a time when I would have just said, please, please, I don't want any association with this. Yet I grew up reading Fate magazine, so the ghosts and stuff, I was okay. And well, to a point, when I started having my own intuitive stuff, I kept saying, please, I don't want to see dead people. And then the guidance came with that, they're not dead, they're just energy, get over it.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So that became more okay. It was just that once you get in this UFO field, then there's the society thing of, okay, you're a nutcase. But having said that, I kept getting all of this stuff that thrust this information in front of me. And background for me has also been journalist. And that was a thing I had to, you know, say, well, now I can't do my news anchor stuff because I've gone off the deep end. And so I backed away. And then I thought, well, you know what? Nobody else is really giving this its fair due. It's all being that hokey little, let's play the scary music, cue the alien tape and go from there. And absolutely not what I'm experiencing with this. It's more of a, going back to that altered state, when people are different in different states of awareness, they have access to information that we don't have when we're stuck in this material view that everything here is what we see. And there is so much here that we can't see unless we get out of that lockstep programming. It's just incredible that these things are happening, and most of us can't see it because we're just not looking. We're simply in autopilot most of the time. And to give you an example, I was given intuitively information to go to a certain spot from one part of town to the other and given a direction. So I did the path, and I'm just telling you a really brief overview. But I knew at the time this was that paranormal. There were some things happening that was that paranormal connection. So I did it. At one point, I deviated. When I deviated, I took a detour and I looked out on the pond that was beside me, and the geese were forming a perfect question mark in the water, the formation of a question mark. That wouldn't happen in my everyday reality. And they might have done a V, they might have done something, but to form a question mark in response to me taking an uncharted detour. I wasn't supposed to do that. And then the person beside me, who I had told, this is what I'm supposed to do, you're going with me, blah, blah. He says, I guess they're wondering why you did that too, aren't they? Ha ha. But the one thing that did was validate my experience. If I hadn't deviated from that prescribed course and that what I had been given as a task to do, then I would never have had that real big affirmation for me that what I experienced was something beyond anything I had experienced in my life, and also gave me a concrete frame of reference to say, all right, I'm not going to poo-poo anybody else's stuff anymore. There's something going on here. We have to connect the dots. The more we talk about it, the more viable resources we uncover in a way to give us some kind of validation. Like you said, the contactee thing with the men in black is that limo. Why the limo? Why the men in black? Well, you know, the other thing you can't do with a guy in black, you can't make him into Bigfoot. You can't. He's a certain kind of label that we can give a definition to without, and still, it's like a ghost. It's like putting on a white sheet. We still don't know what they are. We just know that that's the costume they come in. And I can tell you, when they show up, your world's going to change.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, that's good. You know, that's exactly the sort of experience I had, where it's clear, you know, something's telling you something or trying to tell you something. And the important thing is to take notice of it. And I think if you don't, you know, it moves on to someone who's perhaps more willing to listen and embrace it. And, you know, and I think the trick is not just to receive the message, but actually to act on it as well. So.
Well, there's the thing of, again, if I had been afraid, then I wouldn't have pursued it. I would have said, no, I'm not going to do this. You're bad. Go away. And it wasn't a negative thing. It was a way of giving me a larger frame of reference. Mm-hmm. To see things that are going on and say, oh, wow, there's more here than we really have any way to describe or to give definition to. And this stuff is happening all the time. And the indigenous cultures didn't have to go to a book to learn something. They allowed it to become part of their knowing and their life experience as they went through it. And I think that's what we're kind of lacking in our Western culture of, well, if it isn't in a book, then it isn't real. Mm-hmm. So keep writing your books, Nick, okay?
All right. Well, thank you. I'll definitely do that.
Yeah, because that's how it becomes real for a lot of the people in Western culture. When you did contactees, I want to get into that. Was there a uniform kind of experience that went along with that?
Well, yeah, there is. I mean, you know, I think when it comes to the contactee movement, for people who aren't sort of fully aware of that, it's, you know, the scenario is that people, going back to the 1950s at least, and probably a lot earlier, had encounters out in the, you know, desert locations, remote locations, with very human-looking aliens, very often described as having heads of long blonde hair. And they became known as the Space Brothers, and the people who had the interaction with them became known as the contactees. Some of the more famous ones were people like George Van Tassel, George Adamski, Truman Bethlehem, Orfeo Angelucci. And these are people who felt compelled to go out to desert locations where they would interact with this sort of higher entity that would often sort of talk about, you know, the perils of atomic warfare and how we need to change our ways, etc. Now, because these stories are so controversial, they tend to polarize people into two camps. You know, there are people who believe the stories and people who believe them literally, and there are people who just write them off as hoaxes and delusions. Now, my view is that the reason why the contactee movement gets sort of such a bad rap is because people insist, for the most part, on looking at them from those two particular perspectives. And I think, like the Men in Black mystery, it's very different. I think there's a phenomenon which is trying to teach us and interact with us. And again, with respect to the contactees, I think he does so in somewhat of an altered state of mind where, you know, these people go out and they don't just have a nuts and bolt experience in the desert. It's clear when you read some of these stories that it parallels things like shamanic experiences, you know, where the shaman will go out into the desert and fast for 2 days and then have these visionary, enlightening experiences. And to me, the contactee movement is sort of like a modern-day upgrading of that scenario. You know, the idea that whatever's going on, it's the phenomenon has sort of upgraded itself for a new audience in the way it appears. And so I think, you know, the idea of the space brother, the literal image, I'm not sure it's sort of a flesh and blood entity or something, again, that this phenomenon in some sort of ethereal form, you know, projects into the mind of the person, but to get a message across, you know, of changing our ways and then opening their minds to different paradigms and things like that. So I think that to me is, you know, how my views on the contactee movement have progressed, you know, from the idea that it's either hoaxing or it's literal, very human-looking aliens with bizarre names from Venus, you know, as some people talked about, which sounds controversial, to looking at it from the perspective that there's a phenomenon that's sort of picking up on our perceptions, our subconscious beliefs, and then projecting them back to us in a way that we can understand and relate to the phenomena.
Okay, Don Mack did a lot of work with contactees. Mm. And were you familiar with that? I didn't. He was the first person that I thought was just really trying to do the best that he could to bring forth credible evidence.
Yeah, I think, you know, the important thing about John Mack, you know, a lot of people have written about contactees and abductions, you know, and Mack was certainly you know, one of the people who really brought the abduction mystery to the public's eye and also to the media's eye because of his background, you know, and his standing and position. But I think where Mack differed from a lot of abduction researchers who just sort of focus on the very much nuts and bolts scientific angle of the subject, he recognized that, you know, that there was a spiritual angle to this in some respects, that the people were sort of profoundly changed and it was almost like they were put on a pathway. You know, it wasn't just as simplistic as alien scientists coming here and, you know, taking our DNA, etc. That may be a part of the story, but it was more than that. You know, there seems to be, again, something that sort of challenges us to take our own sort of steps further. And I think Mack recognized this and he realized that, you know, it wasn't just a scientific phenomenon. It was something to do with, I guess, enlightening us as a species or individually.
I like the way that when you're in the book talking about men going, flipping back here, back to the Men in Black, the trickster phenomenon.
Oh, yeah.
And I do believe that plays a great count. It kind of highlights when you have these kinds of encounters where you are spiritually, where what you have developed into at this point as to what you are able to integrate from your encounter. And the trickster is a huge clue.
Yeah, I mean, trickster phenomenon, you know, that goes back centuries or probably until, you know, recorded history. The trickster phenomenon is sort of a strange one and sort of relates to, you know, the way in which people have had experiences with something that seems to manipulate them. And, you know, they're not sure why or how it happens, but it does happen. You know, it's a phenomenon that seems to be as playful and sometimes malevolent. You know, I think, again, it's dependent upon how the person reacts to it, how the person relates to it and what they can get out of it and what the phenomenon wants them to get out of it. And, you know, I mean, you can go back 500 years and, you know, read about stories like fairies and goblins back then where they were definitively trickster-like. You know, they would, I don't mean, you know, the sort of imagery we have today of fairies, of sort of little ethereal girls with, you know, wings, etc. That wasn't the original scenario. If you go back sort of 500 years, they were sort of the definitive shadowy little people that would surface at night and, you know, play tricks on people and help them and etc. But also they could be, you know, they could be sort of harsh teachers as well as, you know, playful teachers. And I think that's what we're seeing in the UFO phenomenon as well, is that it just constantly plays with us as a means to help us, I think, and teach us, but it does so in a fashion where it demands our attention, and if we don't pay attention, sometimes it goes away. Other times, it will do something to say, hey, you know, you are going to listen, like it or not, you know, and that's when it kind of goes down a bit more of the more, I guess, the malevolent path. You know, it's kind of like shaking us up and saying, hey, you will listen, you know, or else.
And I, yeah, I can vouch for that. I tell you, during the time that I had that encounter, it was an extraordinary window. And there was a lot of stuff going on where you feel paranoid. And at the same time, you know you're not, because you have this sense that there is someone watching every move. And the way I got through it was to just let it be whatever choice or decision I made, let it be for the good of the greater, for my highest good, because there was a temptation to react or to fight or to be angry. And then I thought, this isn't feeding, the anger doesn't serve me. So how do I do this? And I never felt more alive than during that process of determining every move and every reaction to get whatever it was to stop bugging me. But knowing it was there and having this validation, things would happen and that people would walk by the house on phones. And it was just this, I tell you, the paranoia that went along with that was, I know why people take drugs. Because, but there was also then synchronicity. Something would let me know that this was indeed what I was experiencing. And again, I just had to go with that thing of I'd already had a very good, solid connection with my own sense of spirit, my own sense of the good that is here in all of us. And I thought, this is just my test. And so when I did that, the things gradually dissolved. But it was a wonderful affirmation that there is so much more here that we really, really do need to explore it and need to bring it into the light so that people can then, when they have this stuff, realize you have to conquer your fear first before any of this stuff is going to make sense or before we really have a handle on how to do scientific research. Does that make sense?
No, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I think, you know, the investigating UFOs and paranormal phenomena is as much about investigating it as it is opening our minds to what's going on. You know, it's no point just investigating UFOs from the perspective that they're just nuts and bolts equivalents of Apollo astronauts or whatever, you know, NASA astronauts. They're not. You know, there's more to it. And I think the challenge is to not be biased and just say, well, I'm just going to investigate this and that and from this perspective. No, I think when you start looking into it, the phenomena then challenges you to be more open-minded and look into different areas as well. And, you know, I think when it tells us that, you know, it's foolish not to follow that path and, you know, to make people realize that, you know, the phenomenon is trying to make us realize that it isn't just as it appears on the surface. And it's a tragedy, I think, if people ignore the stranger aspects because it doesn't sit comfortably with them. And sometimes, as I said, it moves on and targets somebody else. Other times, you know, it'll be sort of like a harsh teacher where the person thinks, you know, why is this phenomenon just pummeling me in what seems a very negative fashion? But it's really because I think they recognize the importance, the phenomena realizes the importance of the person or what they're doing. And so it kind of shakes them out of the tree, so to speak, to say, yes, you will listen. And if you don't, you know, it's going to be tough for you. But ultimately, you'll understand it was for the greater good. So.
Well, I tell you, just from going through it from my perspective, it made me very conscious of something else that's here and trying to understand us and giving us these little tweaks and these little punches and the whatever it is to say, okay, who are you really? And what would your choice be? It's like us studying apes, which we have yet to stop doing in the USA as lab experiments, which anyway, I think that's one of the things that we are doing ourselves that shows us that if we're doing this to the apes and they're doing this to us, then what about this picture isn't okay, you know? They're looking to see what we are as a species and what we have as maybe some either, you know, the best and the worst in our list of attributes. I do think that that's what they're looking at. And who they are, I don't know. But I can say it is real. And it isn't something that's just a piece of Hollywood fiction. Once you get into this, I like the admonition at the back of the book when you say, okay, now I've got your attention. I like the ending. Yeah. So I don't know if you want to ruin the end of the book, but I do like the that little thing that you throw out as a warning for people who might be tempted to say, oh yeah, that was a great book, and then and still pursue it. If you do that and say it was just, you know, an overview and walk away, that's great. But sometimes people just by opening up that little door find themselves in a room that they hadn't expected.
Yeah, I think, you know, that this is all important. You know, it's you know, what you've just said then is sort of, you know, sort of convinces me, you know, that we're doing the right thing collectively. You know what I mean? That we're sort of all on the same page if we're open-minded and willing to go with it.
Open-minded is a way of saying, yeah, objective. Don't put out there what you expect as your result. Let the result show you what might happen. And that was the thing that I was trying to quantify with science. Too many times there's an expectation and then it just becomes self-fulfilling or you're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, you're right. And I think what this tells me is that a lot of people who sort of gravitate to these sort of phenomena, I don't think it's by accident. You know, I think a lot of it could be, I won't say fully pre-planned, but, you know, it's almost as if when you kind of pop up, when you sort of look for these things, I think you pop up on their radar and they then kind of get their grips into you. And I don't necessarily mean that from a bad perspective, you know, just from the perspective that, you know, you literally just appear on their blip, so to speak, and then they determine if you're someone who, you know, can help people take this phenomena further. And so I think, you know, the phenomena itself is, you know, helps direct the people in the field, but the people in the field have a role, perhaps even like a pre-planned role to play already without realizing it.
And I think it's our energy. I do think that we operate at different frequencies. Each body, each person, each being is unique. And when you start thinking in different ways, then your brain fires different patterns that creates different lights, different energetics, harmonics, vibrations, the whole nine yards. And there are others here who work on that better than we do because they actually know it exists.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everybody, I think, has their own sort of role to play in these types of phenomena. And, you know, I mean, none of us are sort of bigger or better than anybody else. I think that's the important thing. You know, we should sort of throw away egos and all that sort of stuff and just realize that, you know, we're all sort of being taught to try and understand what's going on and let's listen to it. Don't have the dogmatic approach that, no, it's just this or it's just that and I'm going to ignore all this. Just embrace it and see where it leads you.
Well, I think that that's what the scientist is all about, that forever curious and the visionary, the explorer. It takes somebody who says, hey, what if? And, you know, I know what the odds are, but I also trust there's something in a higher knowing that knows better.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it knows better than we do, whatever it is.
Yeah. So eventually, maybe, you know, in this lifetime, we'll get a clue. If not, I'm certainly going to enjoy the journey and the exploration. I appreciate you being here. I want to mention real quickly that if you're hearing this story and following along, Nick has a lot more great material. You can check out his books, Nick, and it's redfernbooks.blogspot.com. Okay, so Nick Redfern's books.blogspot.com. And the one we're talking about, The Real Man in Black, but contactees. And is there any other thing you would like to promote before we get out of here?
Just one thing. I'm actually speaking on the weekend of the 30th of September, October the 1st, at the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles on my book, The Real Men in Black. And if people want to come along, I'll be giving a workshop on the whole phenomenon and what it means and how to interact with it, etc., if you want to interact with it. That'll, as I said, that's a Conscious Life Expo weekend, September 30th, October 1st.
All right. Thank you. It's been a delightful interview. I appreciate all the work you're doing and the fact that you're giving us more fodder so we can explore this area and maybe think we have a handle on it.
All right. I appreciate having me on the show, Wendy. Thank you.
Nick Redfern is my guest. And if you'd like to find out more about conscious living, you can check that out on Empower Radio or Facebook. Thanks for listening. Remember, think the best thoughts. That's what comes back to you.